Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Governor Jay Nixon joins us. As usual, there's a lot going on in state government these days. The budget's in place, the legislative session's almost over, with lots of work still ahead, and the governor himself is facing the final months of his last term. I spoke to the governor during his visit to St. Louis on Friday and asked what he's looking for from the legislature in its final days.
Well, first of all, I'm very appreciative that in a bipartisan way the legislature got the budget to me early. I mean, we look across to Illinois and they don't have a budget from last year. We look over at Kansas and they're unable to fund the budget that they have. So while there will be some differences in what the perfect number is and the fact that the legislature came together and in early fashion got that budget to me is extremely important. And that's one of the reasons why just this week we were reaffirmed once again with the highest credit rating in the country, that triple-triple-A gold standard. So the fiscal part is not unimportant. Now, to what gets done legislatively the rest of the term. My hope is that the legislature, they have put a few ethics bills on my desk. There are a number still in play. I think with what has happened, getting rid of contribution limits, other challenges we saw last year with the Speaker and some folks in the Senate, I hope they continue to move those bills forward and get a series, the rest of an important swath of ethics bills to my desk. We also think that there is, like I say, there's some things out there just don't need to be law. And so you mentioned SJR 39, which I don't think putting discrimination in our Constitution is going to help us, and we'll be working to make sure some of those don't make it over the finish line. But I think that of the swath of issues that are out there right now, there's going to be a significant continued effort to make sure we get the ethics bills through the legislature in the last 2 weeks.
How about voter photo ID? Is that something you could ever sign?
I'm somebody that believes we should try to make it as easy as possible for people to vote, not put impediments to vote. So I've kind of on the other side of the debate of that. I'm trying to look at ways in which folks can have early voting or vote on the weekends before or things of that nature. Putting up impediments to make it more difficult, especially for senior citizens, minorities, and disabled folks who may not have a driver's license to vote, just doesn't seem like me a positive step forward in a democracy.
Another issue that is getting some attention right now is the potential for a fuel tax. 6 cents, I think, is what they're talking about. Is that something that makes sense to you?
The proposal that I supported early in the year was a smaller tax increase than that, but would it be within the Hancock limit, so we could just go ahead and do it, much as Iowa just did. The bottom line is we need more long-term, more investment in transportation. We have the seventh longest road system in the country. We're right here in the middle of the country. Transportation is very important, but one of the lowest income lines to pay for that with mileage going up of vehicles. We're going to need to do something. I don't think that the little Band-Aid the legislature did this year with that $20 million for a cost share program is anywhere near what the long-term needs are. So if that gets the ballot to increase that small increase, especially with fuel prices now, I suppose I'd support it. I'm not sure it's going to make it through the House. I think the better method would have been to do a small amount now to begin the process of building the transportation system for the future.
The legislature has taken some money away from the University of Missouri, your alma mater, correct?
Yes, they have.
$3.6 million, something like that. It was a punitive action. How does the governor feel about the legislature taking punitive action against a state institution?
Well, I don't think that punishing the university financially, which ultimately leads to more difficulty to do their mission, is the proper method to mete out punishment if I even agreed with them on what they were punishing about. So that's why I'm very proud that over the last few months. I mean, if you look at where we were in January, I mean, they were talking about zeroing out their budget, and as the budget came through the House, higher education was zeroed out as far as any increases. We're now in a situation where we got a base funding increase, including University of Missouri, of 4% in a performance funding model, a tuition freeze for next year, and a total of $71 million new dollars for higher education, which means the balance for the University of Missouri system will be far more than what it would have been. And so it's a net positive overall, but I don't think that was the right method to deal with whatever differences of opinion they had about students expressing First Amendment opinions last year.
You're in town now, as we're talking, a couple of days before this airs, for a special program called No Kid Hungry, correct?
Right.
What is that all about? And are kids really going hungry in the 21st century in the United States of America?
Yes, they are. I mean, and the thing about childhood hunger is it's a solvable problem. And the place where we can make the most significant progress, we were at Afton, a middle school in Afton today. They have a student program there that coordinates to make sure that they have school breakfasts available for kids just in pickup bags and whatnot, and removing the stigma from kids that need food. They also have a garden and things of that nature. So working with a national organization called Share Our Strength in a program called No Kid Hungry, in which we can take available federal dollars, no additional state resources, and make sure that schools have active school breakfast programs and after-school programs so that kids that are in need of food can get healthy nourishment when they need it.
It really is hard to fathom that we have to deal with this in this day and age.
It really is. I mean, especially when I spend most of my time concerned when I look down at the scale trying to get a lower number as opposed to a higher number. But the bottom line is it exists. And quite frankly, it exists not just in the cities but in some rural areas. And there's a significant stigma to it. Plus, it happens because, quite frankly, I mean, the science is there. If kids are well-fed, they're going to do better in school. And quite frankly, these days, sometimes the kids that aren't getting food are not necessarily poor. They're just so busy. I mean, whether they're running cross-country in the morning before school and they forget to get a breakfast, they don't do as well in the math test. Making sure that we get good nourishment for these kids and they start a life understanding that good quality food will lead to a healthier, longer lifestyle is something that we can be helpful on. And working with these nonprofit organizations using existing federal dollars, coordinating with kids, we think we can make progress.
You know, I wanted to bring something up that you may or may not have given much thought to, but we have here, and that is, and I think it's related to the hunger issue you've just been talking about, and that is we've done a lot of reportage on young people, very young people, K through third grade kids, suffering out-of-school suspensions. You've been hearing about that at all?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it's anytime you're having out-of-school suspensions for kids of that age, you are putting in play a whole series of other potential problems. Yeah. And we've got to work very hard to keep discipline in our schools, but to find ways that we're not just pushing those kids back into difficult homes or out on the street at a very young age where they can get into much more trouble than they would if we can keep them in schools. That's why I'm a big supporter of alternative schools at all ages so that kids remain in that school system even when they need to be disciplined.
The overwhelming majority of these kids who are suspended are black. And, you know, I know that this is an issue that is dealt with on an individual school district basis. It's a discipline issue. But I wonder if you consider that acceptable, that this is happening, and is there any role the state could play in dealing with this?
Well, I'll only say that after the difficult challenges 2 years ago in Ferguson, unlike some states that have had challenges, we have listened, we've learned, and we're trying to do better. And so consequently, discussions of this type are now had out in the open with, journalists and public officials and whatnot. And we are not saying, oh, that's not a problem in our state. We are instead saying when you look at the numbers and you have a disproportionate of one ethnicity or one region, then we need to look at the processes around this. It's one of the reasons why we've made significant changes just this year in our police officer standard of training to get a number of changes in that. The bottom line is that when you see overwhelming numbers of any race or ethnicity which have more significant challenges in any area, then you need to study it and look at it so that people, regardless of their background, can have an equality of opportunity.
You mentioned Ferguson. Let's go there for a moment.
Sure.
You took a little heat during that whole episode. Mm-hmm. Looking back on that, is there anything you can think of that you might have done differently or would do differently?
Well, I mean, when I look back, I mean, I would do things differently today than I've done. I mean, we all, sure, given the benefit of hindsight, but the point for me, the bigger point was we established principles at the beginning of that process, and our two significant principles, for the purpose of this short discussion here, were speech and safety. And I don't think anybody doubts that there was a lot of free speech. That there was plenty of speech there. Everybody got to say what they wanted. As far as the safety side, I think it is important to note that through all of those couple of months, 3 months, where there was a great deal of turmoil, there wasn't anyone else shot or killed on either side of the discussion. And when you compare that to the over 50 people killed after Rodney King and those riots, the almost 100 in Detroit when those riots, the deaths in Cincinnati when they had their riots, I'm very proud of our law enforcement and other teams that worked hard to literally protect the rights of people to protest. And once again, things aren't perfect, and I'm not saying, but I do think that the changes that we're making as a result of what happened are going to make a long-term difference. These court shifts of saying that municipal courts are not going to be there for the purpose of just raising money for a city, instead meeting out justice, those shifts are going to have long-term positive effects. And many of the recommendations made by the Ferguson Commission and the continuing Ferguson Forward movement, I think all of those are going to continue to help us be a better region long run.
But aren't the court shifts in some doubt right now with regard to the Missouri Supreme Court?
There will be on one portion of it, the percentage, I think there'll be some issues. But for your – it's nice to be on public radio. I can actually go in full sentences and multisyllabic words here for a moment. The smaller percentage that cities in St. Louis County are able to keep under that bill relative to the other cities, the difference between 15 and 20% of their net revenues. That issue, even if that issue is lost, the number of 20 is much lower than what it is now, and that part of the law will still be sustained. So really all you're tussling about is whether St. Louis ought to have a little more stringent standard than the rest of the state, and the standard for the rest of the state under that bill is much more stringent than it was before. So yes, there are risks involved in the level, but the concept behind it and the strength of that law and the limitations on jailing people for non-payment and things of that nature, those portions are not part of the sections of the law that are in challenge before the courts.
Back to the incident of August of 2014 and beyond, there was some heat that your office took from business owners, lost property and lost money. They lost a lot of valuable assets that they had at the time. They basically said that the governor didn't live up to plans to help them. Have you talked to these folks at all? Or
certainly, we've talked a lot of them. We're working with them to rebuild. I think that it's important. It was a dangerous night. I think there were some reactions that night that there was gunfire. I mean, you're not going to ask a fireman unarmed to go into gunfire to put out a fire. I mean, you're not asking. They don't sign up for the duty of combat. They sign up for the other duty. And while we were certainly the images were not good and the loss of property, we're working very hard to make sure that is taken care of. Overall, the fact that we didn't have a loss of life, we didn't have a significant injuries or anything that night. I think when history looks at this, they will, they won't be happy to see those images, but they'll be put in perspective. If we would have had National Guardsmen or cops that would have fired back that night as opposed to stepping back just a little bit. Think about the history of Kent State and look at how long we as a country have had to deal with that. An unarmed, young African-American shot in the streets of Ferguson that night would have been a legacy that would have lasted much longer than the rebuilding of a building.
So you're pretty solid with your action through that period.
You wish nothing would happen. You wish that the federal government and the local government would announce their charging decisions at the same time. You know, that was one of the original reasons why I reached out to the Justice Department and had them cooperate with the local authorities so that there would be a combined investigation. And I thought separating those at the last moment didn't help. But I'm not one to spend my time looking over my shoulder. I do think that we had information there. We kept people safe. Either a local citizen being hurt that night or a fireman being hurt. Somebody else would have cast a significant shadow over what I think is going to be long run an opportunity for Missouri to lead on very, very difficult and challenging issues.
You mentioned the word image a moment ago, and it's something a lot of us, all of us, have been thinking about because of Ferguson and because of other things that have happened, even the Senate Resolution 39.
Exactly.
And the incidents down the Mizzou campus last fall, it's given the state a very negative image perception here and beyond here, even internationally. You're the governor of the state. I mean, this is something that you have to kind of live with.
Well, yeah, when we spend a lot of time, and I've traveled internationally to talk to folks about it and continue to move forward. The economy of our state's moving forward. Our unemployment rate is far below the national average. We're adding jobs. We're moving forward. We just got the National Geospatial, almost $1.7 billion construction project here. The bottom line is, yes, there's discussion about these, but I think that people make a mistake to conflagrate the challenges that occurred at Ferguson with the challenges at the University of Missouri. I think they were far different. I don't think any of those students there were in danger. And once again, they got to exercise their First Amendment rights. And one could argue whether the football team should have said what they said or not. But that's one could also argue that the way they were playing, they'd gone on strike a couple of weeks beforehand. But you know, the point is that I don't put those two together. And I know the public externally can try to do that, but we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that people know how fine the people of Missouri are, how if there's a problem, we don't hide away from it. We try to work our way through it. And I think that's one of the points of resilience that's going to pay off in the long run for the Show Me State.
The perception seems to be that Missouri is racist, Missouri is homophobic, things like that. That's the way people look at us.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at SJR 39, though. It was a bipartisan group of legislators that just said no. Mm-hmm. After the Senate passed it. I mean, I said, and after that was done, that's a moment in history there. I don't think that bill will come back. I think we are beyond that discrimination, and this is a very significant moment. And I think that the external pressure that some folks saw, whether it was the NFL saying they wouldn't have the Super Bowl in Georgia, or the NBA saying they wouldn't have the All-Star game in North Carolina, or all of the challenges that have occurred for Governor McCrory and others because of this PayPal not moving forward an economic development project in North Carolina. The bottom line is I think that some of this external pressure was helpful in giving a context to members of the legislature in a bipartisan way that this was not the best path forward for our state.
Just one other area I want to get to. I know you're in a hurry to move on, but I'm curious to get your impression of what's going on nationally in this presidential race. And you're like the rest of us trying to figure it out.
I'm not a political prognosticator, but were I, it would be very clear that the Democratic nominee is well on her way to be elected the next president of the United States. That's also someone I support. So that's why what's gone on in the shallowness of discussion, in the xenophobic attitudes, and in the, you know, flat out meanness of policies, and I mean the lightness of intellectual touch by Trump and some others is disappointing, but I think ultimately I have a deep trust in the electorate, not only of Missouri but of America, that will elect the most qualified, capable candidate to be the next president of the United States.
How much potential do you think there is, given all that's going on, for the Democratic Party to regain control of the Senate?
I think it will have an effect on the federal races. I'm not sure that effect will run all the way down to a city councilman or a state representative race in Winona or Puxico or something. But I do think at the national level, people connect the United States Senate especially with the executive branch. And I think it will have significant effects for folks like Senator Kirk in Illinois, Senator Portman in Ohio. Folks like that are going to have a hard time winning if they can't stand next to their presidential candidate, and he, if it's Trump, continues to spew very light intellectual, very heavy xenophobic and mean rhetoric.
Republican senators are contesting in five states that were won by President Obama last time around, and the five states is all that would be necessary for Democratic control.
I do believe that if I thought Trump, who everybody continues to say is going to pivot and turn into somebody rational, missed that opportunity the other evening as he glided down to Trump Tower to continue to bark the way that he has to date, and so I think that if he is their nominee and he continues in the vein he's in, then I think that clearly there will be Senate races that are affected.
And what is the influence, do you think, of Bernie Sanders on Hillary Clinton in terms of moving her more to the left?
I think that elections, regardless of the TV shows here in the primary, elections are won in the center. And she's a centrist candidate and is paying a price for that with Bernie nudging her from the left. And so I ultimately believe, as somebody who's run a campaign for an executive position, that the campaigns will reflect what's necessary to get the votes. But ultimately, in the personal times I've spent with both Hillary and former President Clinton, they're very serious people. Very much centrist, very much trying to get things done. And I think that Sanders' impact to sensitize, whether it's Democrat or Republican, to the plight of the middle class, to the plight of students with too much debt, to the fear we have of foreign trade because of so many jobs have been lost, all of those are legitimate issues that Secretary Clinton I think, have a better education on because of Bernie Sanders and more sensitivity to how important they are. It's quite frankly, those are issues in which the right and the left have kind of agreed.
You'll be at the convention?
Absolutely.
Looking forward to it?
I really enjoy the convention. I've been in every one since 1988, and I enjoy that part of American democracy.
Jay Nixon, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thanks, Doc.
That, of course, was Governor Jay Nixon in an interview that we recorded last Friday. We're going to spend a few minutes with political reporter Jason Rosenbaum now and get his take on that interview with the governor. Okay, Jason, what's your take?
Well, I have seen the governor speak at press conferences before. I've seen him make speeches before. I hadn't really seen him sit down on a one-on-one interview quite in depth as the one you did with him. And I thought he was kind of coming out of his shell a little bit. I thought his answers were a little bit less talking pointy, if that's a word. And you could really tell that he was able to speak his mind a little bit more freely, probably because he's terming out of office and I think he's being more reflective on his service. Obviously, the questions about Ferguson interested me as someone who's talked to a lot of business owners. I'm not sure if that's going to be a response that's going to satisfy a lot of those business owners who saw their livelihoods completely ruined when their buildings were burned down. But I feel like although he made those sentiments before, I think that it was a bit more of an in-depth answer than what we're used to do on that particular topic.
He clearly feels that he did the right thing, primarily because there was no loss of life nor anyone badly injured.
Well, that's his take on it, though. Some would question, though, why he talked about protecting property before the grand jury decision came down, because if you go back and listen to him, that is heavily inferred, if not directly stated. But the fact remains is the past is the past. What happened is what happened. And although the governor is going to be asked about Ferguson and the response probably the rest of his life, we're almost 2 years past this, and it's just we're moving on to other things, so to speak.
Well, very clearly he has indicated that he would not have done anything differently.
That is what he said, and I've even talked to St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar about this. If the National Guard had been there, would it have even changed anything, or would it have the same thing have happened? And he just doesn't know because it just didn't happen. But again, this is going to be a question about it that's going to be with him for as long as he's in the realm of public service and even afterward when we talk about the retrospective impact of his legacy.
Only 30 seconds left. A lot of people think that damaged any potential for him having a spot on any kind of a national ticket or a national presence.
We'll have to see, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that if Hillary Clinton becomes the next president of the United States, there may be a place in her administration for Jay Nixon. He's governor for 8 years, attorney general for 16. That's a lot of experience, and his time in public service may not be over.
Well, we shall see. Jason Rosenbaum, thanks for spending a couple of moments with us and
absolutely
giving us your take on Governor Jay Nixon's comments to us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.